Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Appeals Court of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, in The Hague is expected to rule next week on an appeal to open an investigation into war crimes and atrocities in Afghanistan. While prosecutors say they're investigating conduct by the Taliban and Afghan security forces, it could also have an impact on U.S. conduct by members of the CIA during the early parts of that conflict. This is concerning, to say the least, for the U.S. government. In fact, the Trump administration has issued a visa ban on the prosecutor. And this marks the latest chapter in an uneasy history between the United States and the ICC. The U.S. is one of a handful of countries, including Russia, China, Pakistan, India, and Israel, which didn't ratify the agreement and has at times accommodated but alternatively been hostile to the court. And as you might guess, today's administration is very hostile to the court. My guest today is Ambassador Todd Buchwald, who served as the State Department's Special Coordinator for the Office of Global Criminal Justice from December 2015 to July 2017, when the office was downgraded and he retired from the department. He was a career attorney holding various posts for the State Department, and he's now a lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School. And he was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night, speaking on the U.S.'s relationship with the ICC. Ambassador Buchwald, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's great to be here.
When I think of the International Criminal Court, I think of it as a place for justice for the victims of genocide, ethnic cleansing, and the like. It's sort of a place as a corrective to leaders and countries that commit these acts and as a preventative to those who are tempted to maybe attempt these acts. Has it functioned that way?
It's tried to function that way, and it's functioned that way in some respects. It's got a very mixed record in the 18 years since it started functioning. It has only 4 real convictions for atrocity crimes. It has been sort of the flagship of a broader effort which emphasizes accountability and has spawned other institutions. States more and more incorporate the basic principles into their own law. There are regional courts that have sprung up. It's empowered local advocates who are demanding justice, and it's inspired sort of a general demand for justice. All of those things were sort of anticipated by the framers, and those things have happened at least some, but the record on convictions is not very good at all. It's hard to sort of know whether it has a deterrent effect, but I think it does at least some. There's a famous story about a nun in the Central African Republic, as the church is being attacked. And she comes out and she says bravely, "This church is under the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court," which actually has no meaning, but she was left alone, right? So, you know, there are stories like that out there. But its record is mixed. It's, I think, had some positive effect, and it's trying to sort of improve its record.
Would you say the court has been successful as a whole?
I'd leave it at mixed. Okay. At the end of the day, what a court is supposed to do is to investigate and prosecute atrocity crimes. This court is supposed to investigate and prosecute atrocity crimes. And I think in the main, that's how it needs to be judged. The peripheral effects are good, but from the point of view of the institutions themselves, they haven't delivered as well as they would like to on that. There's an extensive review process going on now. There's a lot of dissatisfaction, not just from countries like us who've been skeptical of the court at various times anyway, but among the traditional supporters. And there's a review process going on, fairly extensive, with lots of input and lots of attention to it, you know, trying to improve it, and we'll see how that goes. I think that beyond the sort of technical kinds of things that the review process is focused on, there are sort of underlying political problems or problems in the nature of its mandate that are hard. There's sort of contradictions in its mandate that come out over time. One of the areas where it has inherent issues that it faces is how does it select the cases that it's going to pursue? And the Rome Statute, the treaty, the ICC treaty that created the court, has rules in it, has basic rules in it about how it's supposed to sort through and filter the cases, how it's supposed to select the worst of the worst to pursue. But the rules they have embedded in the treaty are themselves entail sort of ambiguity, and it's hard to work your way through it. The court actors, the court, the prosecutor, tend to interpret these ambiguous rules in a way that expands their jurisdiction, understandably so, because they don't want a statement that look, we don't care about you. Do what you want. That's the worst possible thing. But they end up in a situation where their jurisdiction covers more than they can actually address. And that creates a situation where, you know, people who want justice are disappointed. They feel like justice is being promised to them and then not delivered. And that undermines its credibility. So that's another thing that they have to work on.
When I think of these cases against individuals or state actors, I think of them going on a long time. And only four convictions in, what is it now, 18 years.
Yeah. There are other convictions for administration of justice, you know, witness tampering kind of things and so forth, but only four for atrocity crimes. And to complete the picture in a way that's not as flattering as one might like, there have been some pretty high-stakes failures, cases that have been brought forward.
A number in Kenya involving atrocities there.
The president and vice president of Kenya, the cases against them fell apart, admittedly with allegations of widespread witness tampering by some of the Kenyans. But nevertheless, the cases fell apart. I would say Kenya is an interesting example, though, because the charges stemmed from election violence in the late 2000s. And, you know, I'm not truly an Africa expert. I follow the court, but I'm not a Kenya expert for sure. But people who do follow Kenya, who I trust, have told me that although those cases fell apart, the election violence did not repeat itself nearly what would have been expected. And that there were a lot of people who attribute that to the sort of specter of getting taken down by the ICC and dealing with it in the future.
Some deterrent effect then.
Some significant deterrent effect, yeah.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned earlier, the U.S. government has always had an ambivalent view at best towards the International Criminal Court. We voted against the treaty that established the court. Of course, the treaty passed overall. President Clinton then signed the treaty, but it was never ratified. And we've only engaged with the court when it suits us. And that's sort of run back and forth depending on an administration. What are the U.S. objections to the ICC?
There are a series of objections that we stated at the time the treaty was being negotiated. And some of them are sort of sound technical, but they go to the risk that prosecutions and investigations might be politicized. At the end of the day, I think the basic concern that we have is that we're not ready to accept a court to put international judges in charge of overseeing us. It's, you know, we're a different country than other countries. We have a different sort of history. It's not a thing that we're comfortable with. And the way the court is set up, unlike many other courts, it's the court that has to select the targets. You know, if you sort of think back to the times of Nuremberg, which is a high point in the quest for accountability historically, but there wasn't really, you know, there was also an element, I wouldn't say of victor's justice because it was deserved, but there was an extent to which, of course, there were no prosecutions to the Allies.
Right.
And if you think about the tribunals, the United Nations created tribunal after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, there was a period where the United Nations Security Council was establishing ad hoc tribunals to deal with some of the worst atrocities. And those were
Yugoslavia and Rwanda.
Yugoslavia and Rwanda, exactly. And of course, again, it was the Security Council selecting the targets. I think they were the right targets, but it's the Security Council, and even the Security Council can't make a decision over the objection of any of its permanent members, including the United States. So there was an extent to which that we were protected from a boomerang. I must say, in the case of Yugoslavia, what ended up happening was we ended up in a war in Yugoslavia. So in fact, we bounced into the jurisdiction of the court, but we managed it, right? Which is the same risk that you have with the International Criminal Court, but we dealt with it professionally. We managed it. We interacted with the court, and the court eventually decided not to pursue any of the allegations that were being lodged about the bombing of Belgrade during the Kosovo War.
Would you say the biggest objection is just the idea of the possibility of the ICC asserting jurisdiction over an American?
I think that's right. The way the court works, it has jurisdiction over these atrocity crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. But there are these filters that I talked about in these rules to help it filter out what it should and shouldn't address. And the rules include that only the gravest crimes, so just the fact that there are allegations that somebody has committed a war crime doesn't mean that the ICC should pursue it. And another very important filter, in a way the most important filter, is called complementarity. And this is the idea that the court is a court of last resort. This stuff is supposed to be handled by states themselves, and only where a state is unable or unwilling to pursue the cases itself should the ICC have a role. And so conceptually, we have, over time, a very strong system of military justice. And advocates of the court, or people who think we should join, say, what are you worried about? You have all this protection. And I think that is a measure of protection, but there are concerns that the court will judge our willingness and our ability in a way differently than we might judge our willingness and ability. They might second guess us, and we can go through some examples of ways that might come up. And there's a concern about being second guessed. And I think there's a concern, and I don't dismiss it at all. These are, you know, I think we need to have sort of a better relationship with the court, but the concerns, it's not that the concerns don't exist, they have to be dealt with. And there's a concern historically that a court like the ICC, which has however many, you know, 122 countries party to the treaty now, inevitably will feel some kind of need. If its goal is deterrence, what better way to create deterrence than, say, even the most powerful are subject to our jurisdiction. Even the most powerful will be called to account. And that creates an incentive, potentially, for them to be more willing or more likely to come after us. Of course, there are a lot of disincentives to coming after us, too. But you can understand the concern. Yeah. The United States has far more troops overseas than other countries, so there are more things that could attract the court's attention.
And because the United States is so, it's a part of so much of the world affairs, if they did bring a case, they would be very easy to issue a subpoena at some point or a warrant?
We're in a lot of places. It's there's a risk. It's not that easy to get a case going.
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah.
with the 18 cases. And it's not that easy, even if you have the sort of evidence and information. If you sort of think through how it would work in the real world, the ICC has no police force, right? The ICC has to work through national jurisdictions. You know, if you sort of think about the court pursuing a case against an American, you know, what does that really mean? That means that the British police are going to arrest some senior American official as he transits Heathrow Airport on the way back from summer vacation. And, you know, I can't say that that couldn't happen, but it seems very unlikely to me, whatever the obligations are, that that is a scenario that's really going to sort of play itself out.
My guest today is Ambassador Todd Buchwald. He's formerly the Special Coordinator of the State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice, where he worked with the International Criminal Court. He's now teaching at George Washington University Law School, and he spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on how the U.S. should engage with the International Criminal Court. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, there is a case that is in the preliminary, it's not even a preliminary investigation, but there is a prosecutor that wants to put a preliminary investigation into place in Afghanistan. Is that correct?
That is correct. And actually, as I landed in Tulsa today, I was informed in my email that the court, the appeals chamber, the appeals judges for the ICC will be issuing a decision of some sort on this case next Thursday.
And we should mention that the prosecutor tried to bring a court, a judge dismissed it at that point,
and that
decision was appealed.
Yeah, the ICC prosecutor has been conducting what they call a preliminary examination, which is a process by which they decide whether to conduct an investigation. So since 2007, 2008, someplace in there. So it's been going on for a long time. And if you think about Afghanistan, there are lots of bad things that have happened in Afghanistan. And so an investigation of the situation in Afghanistan would encompass atrocities by the Taliban, crimes by the Afghan security forces. There are lots of allegations of detainee prisoner abuse. And also it could encompass allegations about U.S. torture in the early 2000s, which is a difficult issue. The prosecutor submitted an application to the lower court, the lower ICC judges, a while ago. And surprisingly, the lower judges decided not to authorize the investigation to go forward. And there was lots of speculation about why that was. Had they caved to American pressure, this kind of thing. And the reasoning they used to defend not authorizing the investigation was reasoning that looked sort of different than what people, including me, had expected. So the prosecutor didn't get the authorization to proceed, has then appealed that decision, and in some form that appeal will be answered next week. It could be many things. It could affirm what the denial of an authorization to investigate. It could reverse it and say you do have authorization to investigate. or I think there's a pretty reasonably good chance that it can do something like remand it to the lower court. The rules you applied were wrong. Apply these rules and then come back to us after that. So we'll see. We don't know. But it definitely got my attention when I saw the email.
Now, one of the tenets of the ICC is that it acts in a case where a state actor doesn't act. Now, on some of the notions of abuse that occurred by U.S. forces in Afghanistan, those were addressed within the state. But I think the idea of torture that happened very early has not been addressed.
Right.
The allegations of
that's
torture.
The concern is that it will be seen that way. There was, within the U.S. government and the Justice Department, there was a prosecutor appointed to look at this stuff at the beginning of the Obama administration. And at the end of the day, there were no formal investigations or prosecutions.
But there have been military cases, though.
The military cases are different. The military case, yeah. The real things that catch your attention when you sort of think about this, in my opinion, and the things that you read about in the Senate Intelligence Committee report are allegations against the CIA.
Yeah.
And they're documented. They're in these reports. There it is. And basically, there weren't really prosecutions. So there's a feeling of vulnerability. I actually think that I'm sure I'm a partisan, having worked for the United States government, I think that the court should not pursue these. But there's a lot of feeling in other parts of the world that these are the kinds of cases that the ICC should pursue. Whether they could pursue it effectively is a whole other question. And the lower court, when it denied the prosecutor the right to go forward, focused on the idea that you're never going to be able to pursue this successfully. And it's a diversion of resources that should go to things that are more likely to produce results.
Now, there is another case that affects U.S. interests, and that would be another potential investigation in Palestine, what they refer to as Palestine and the West Bank and what's happened there.
So this is a very – all these stories are complicated.
Yeah, right,
This one is very complicated. The issue – the underlying issue or the threshold issue in that case is whether Palestine really is a state. And the way the jurisdiction of the court works, they can – pursue cases where that occur on the territory of a state that's joined the ICC treaty or mm-hmm. by nationals of a state that's joined the ICC treaty. So the issue is, can they pursue cases on the territory of Palestine? And that's only true if Palestine actually is a state. The prosecutor has taken a view that for purposes of the ICC treaty, their state – this is sort of an overgeneralization, but they're a state because the UN has treated them like a state. And I think that is we'll find out what the court thinks about that. They've now asked for a decision from the court. Is this a basis on which to proceed? The court has solicited amicus briefs on this issue. And I submitted an application and was granted, and I'll be filing a brief in mid-March, I think it's March 16th. And I'll say, of course, what I think, which is that the analysis of the prosecutor isn't quite right, that it shouldn't be that the decision on whether Palestine is a state turns on a vote in the General Assembly. A decision by a court that's supposed to be independent and impartial has to be based on its independent and impartial assessment of the facts. And, we'll see how that goes, but it's a very complicated issue, and it's very sensitive here and in Israel. The allegations that would be in play include allegations that the Israeli settlements on the West Bank are war crimes. Mm. And that's a hard issue for the Israelis because unlike other allegations, you used too much force, you had an illegal target, the Israelis do investigate those things, right? They have a strong military justice system. But this is something the Israelis basically think is legal. So it's harder to show that you're able and willing to investigate and prosecute them yourself.
Well, as we were mentioning earlier, the U.S. government has had this sort of pendulum swinging thought process towards the ICC. The early years of the Bush administration strongly opposed it. They then began working with it. The Obama administration worked with it on case-by-case basis. And now, right now, the Trump administration is openly hostile to the ICC. I believe your office that you occupied in the State Department has been downgraded, and even the administration is issuing visa bans on ICC officials. What's your view of the current administration's approach towards the ICC?
I can understand that any administration would be concerned, whether people in your audience agree or disagree, any U.S. administration is going to be concerned about an investigation and prosecution of American personnel. I don't think the right way to go about it is to, in such a sort of volatile and in such a volatile way.
Now, who are the ICC officials that have had visa bans against them?
The one that we know is the prosecutor herself, the head prosecutor.
Is that legal under like the UN and you know, because I would assume they would have dealings with New York.
Right. We have obligations under what's called the UN Headquarters Agreement to allow travel back and forth to New York to conduct UN business, and we respect that. And it's commendable that the administration did that. So she does come to New York. She reports. There are requirements in various resolutions for her to report to the Security Council on some of her cases, and she does that, and is allowed to. She can't come to symposia, law schools, to your radio. I guess you could interview her over there. To radio stations, to the University of Oklahoma.
So she can't go anywhere except to UN headquarters.
That's the idea. Yeah. And it's not as if she came here, she could do investigations anyway. I mean, there are rules that she can't do that, including U.S. laws. And so far as I've ever heard, they've respected those. So it's not as if they're preventing her from doing investigation on American territory. But they've taken this position. One doesn't know what'll happen. One doesn't know how developments in Afghanistan and Palestine and elsewhere will affect it. But over time, as you say, the pendulum has sort of swung back and forth. There's sort of this period of let's snuff the life out of the ICC, and then we find a problem that there's no real other way to deal with. And in the Bush administration, which in the first 4 years, as you say, was very negative policy towards the ICC, by the time of 2004, 2005, President Bush's administration had said that what was happening in Sudan, in the Darfur region of Sudan, constituted genocide. And the issue came up in the Security Council in New York. Should we refer this to the ICC, which is a power the Security Council has? And the Bush administration, which heretofore had done everything it could to sort of snuff the life out of the ICC, relented and allowed the case to go forward. And then, in fact, the U.S. became a big supporter of the case against Sudan. It's like a lot of issues in politics. There are ebbs and flows and pulls and tugs. And there's reasons, pros and cons of both sides. And depending on what's happening at any given time, the pros are accentuated or the cons are accentuated. And right now with Afghanistan, people are focused on, oh, my God, we'll be a defendant, that sort of aspect of it. But the time will come when there's a case, I think, well, what else are we going to do with this? Who else is going to sort of handle this except the ICC?
And is that same statement fairly true for even the signatories countries to this agreement?
It's different for the signatories in this respect. The signatories are, the parties, are obligated to cooperate with the court. We're not a party, so we have no obligation to cooperate in any way. We have not broken our obligations under the ICC treaty by imposing the visa ban. I personally think it's not politically the right thing to do, but it's not a violation of an obligation under the treaty. We have none. Mm.
Yeah, and of course, what's your feeling about the ICC, the U.S. ever ratifying the ICC?
Ever is a long time.
Yeah.
This will disappoint some of the people I deal with who are ICC supporters. I just don't see that happening.
My guess
today is we'd need a paradigm shift, I think, in the United States before that happened.
My guest today is Ambassador Todd Buchwald. He was a former special coordinator of the State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice, which worked with the International Criminal Court. When it worked with the International Criminal Court on certain cases, he spoke to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations. Well, earlier we were talking about the effectiveness of the ICC, and right now, by my count, the ICC has 9 preliminary investigations on countries, another 10 current investigations. It sounds like they're all over the place, and I mean, it's a lot of countries within that sort of middle belt of Africa, some countries in Asia. Trials go on for a long, long time. You say that the court really needs to be as effective as it can be. Is the fact that they're taking on so many cases working to its detriment?
I personally think so. I think it needs, and I think there are a lot of people who think this, it needs to figure out better how to focus itself. And as I say, it's not easy. because there are a lot of bad things happening. And to say that you're not concerned about some bad thing that's happening is itself it's a difficult thing. It's a difficult step. But I do think they need to narrow their focus.
Do you think sometimes they're taking on cases that don't rise to that level of the genocide, ethnic cleansing, or severe ideas that was the basis for the court in the first place?
I think maybe some very small examples of that. I don't think that's really the problem. I think the problem is there's so much of that that it's hard to choose among them. And they have these other criteria for filtering, only the most grave. You know, what the test in the ICC treaty is that the crimes have to be of sufficient gravity. That's a principle, but it doesn't really tell you what that sufficiency is. What is sufficient gravity? And they've got to come up with a way, in my opinion, that narrows their bite to something that they can swallow. And otherwise, it's really sort of an unsustainable position. I think you had about 20 countries that were either under investigation or preliminary examination. That's one out of six. I guess they're not all ICC's parties, but that's one out of six countries. And that's not – you can't have sustainable support if you're sort of that spread thin.
Yeah. When you look at those countries that are in preliminary investigation or in investigation, you look at those individuals and states, they have little influence, little power on the international stage for the most part. And as we were talking earlier about this possible investigation into Afghanistan, the United States is a state that has a lot of both of those. Is there value in the ICC simply pursuing these states that have very little influence and power in the world?
I do think there is. I definitely think there is. I think that, you know, some of the places you're talking about are places where terrible, terrible atrocities have happened. And the fact that the crimes are being perpetrated in a country that's weak doesn't lessen the suffering of the victims at all. And, you know, it is, of course, a very imperfect world, and it's a very much easier to pursue a case in a weak country than in a strong country. But it doesn't mean it shouldn't be pursued. I think it's right for what it's right for what it is.
Yeah. And given the conviction rate, it sounds like it's even difficult to get convictions even against some of these countries.
They're picking up the pace. They're organized, mm-hmm. I think, better now than they used to be. But it is hard. These are big cases far away. There's a problem sort of having sort of a court with the central headquarters in The Hague sort of doing all these things around the world. On the other hand, by pursuing them, I do think they spur more local efforts. I do think they spur local demands for justice. And I do think they have a beneficial effect on the course of the quest for justice that, you know, that really shouldn't be overlooked.
All right. Ambassador Buchwald, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Ambassador Todd Buchwald is the former special coordinator at the State Department's Office of Global Criminal Justice. He's currently teaching at George Washington University Law School. He spoke with the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night on how the U.S. should engage with the International Criminal Court. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.